This is The Takeaway. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess from WNYC Studios, filling in for Melissa Harris-Perry.
Good to be with you today.
On Tuesday of this week, the CDC reported more than 441,000 new COVID cases in the U.S. alone. That's actually the highest number of new cases we've seen in a day since the start of the pandemic. But on Monday, despite the number of infections, the CDC chose to cut COVID-19 quarantine and isolation times in half, from 10 days to 5 days. And just to underline one part of this new guideline that seems to be getting lost, after those initial 5 days, the CDC is still advising anyone who has tested positive to wear a mask around others for the following 5 days. These altered rules may be confusing to the American public. Only a few months ago, people in the U.S. were told to undergo a 14-day quarantine. And that was for anyone who tested positive or came into contact with someone who later tested positive. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci explaining why that decision was made on CNN earlier this week.
But if you are asymptomatic and you are infected, we want to get people back to the jobs, particularly those with essential jobs, to keep our society running smoothly. So I think that was a very prudent and good choice on the part of the CDC, which we spent a considerable amount of time discussing, namely getting people back in half the time than they would have been out so that they can get back to the workplace doing things that are important to keep society running smoothly.
These new guidelines were issued about a week after Airlines for America, a large airline industry group, wrote a letter to the CDC asking them to lower their quarantine recommendations to avoid a labor shortage and other disruptions. So is the policy change about jobs and the economy, or is it about public health? Here to answer some of our questions about the new guidelines is Namandjé Bumpus, director of the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the guidelines?
Yes, so it is a change, as you noted. So currently, a large change is that everyone, regardless of vaccination status, if they've tested positive for COVID-19, are asked to isolate for 5 days if they have no symptoms or if their symptoms are resolving after 5 days. So that time has been cut down to 5 days, but the key there is really being asymptomatic or having symptoms that are resolving. And as you mentioned, after those 5 days, continuing to mask around others for an additional 5 days. If a person does have fever, other symptoms, they should stay home longer. But if they're asymptomatic, the time has been cut to 5 days. And I think the important point there being that it's recommended for everyone regardless of vaccination status.
What's the science behind that halving from 10 to 5 days?
You know, obviously things are still emerging as far as Omicron, but as far as what is currently known, there is strong evidence that transmission or the majority of transmission is really occurring early in the course of the illness. So generally 1 to 2 days prior to the onset of symptoms and then say 2 to 3 days after. So the idea being that if we're trying to capture that window, then isolating for 5 days, after testing positive, if asymptomatic, then there should be minimized risk for infecting others. I think, as I said, we are still learning more about Omicron and how, transmissible it is at different levels of virus. But so far, at least what's been suggested from what we know about, kind of previous SARS-CoV-2 and what's emerging about this variant is that there is that window, the 1 to 2 days prior of symptom onset and then 2 to 3 days after, that most infection seems to be being transmitted.
There are a lot of caveats to the rules, right? It's different if you've been unvaccinated or if you have a booster, then you have to figure out if you have symptoms or if they're resolving. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's 1 to 2 days prior, but generally sticks out to me there. And it just seems like an SAT logic problem to figure out what you should do and what you should do with employees who are sick. Do you worry that there's a lot of room for mistakes in trying to parse this out?
Well, certainly, I think because it can be hard to identify, what is a symptom even. Certainly, I think that there are, some people that may not recognize certain things as a symptom. I've certainly talked to people who have said, oh, it's just a sore throat. So I think that certainly is one place where the interpretation can be difficult because we're talking asymptomatic or symptoms resolving, and people may, you know, view that differently. There is a lot of talk about, you know, there should be a negative test required, for instance, before leaving isolation. I think that one difficulty is that those are still limited. So right now, it really is this timing, you know, relying on this time period, and for people to really, I think hard about what might be a symptom and what might not be. And I think go on the side of, if you are feeling, you know, some symptoms, if you do have a fever, even slight, then staying home longer, certainly. And, you know, talking to your healthcare professional if you feel that you're just having a hard time discerning what might be a symptom, what might not be.
I mentioned that Airlines for America had asked the CDC to cut quarantine time. And I've also seen that interpreted as something that suggests that these rules are not earnestly given by the CDC. Mm-hmm. Do you worry about the erosion of trust here?
I think, yes, with confusion and with people feeling that they're being told different things. But I think at the same time, we're always trying to balance, you know, livelihood and people being able to do the things that they need to do in their lives, you know, go to work, care for others with what we know. So the quarantine guidelines have, you know, changed as well, as you noted, where if you've been boosted or if you've been, you know, fully vaccinated recently, so completed the Pfizer, Moderna in within 6 months or the J&J within the last 2 months, then, you know, wear a mask for 10 days, test on day five if possible. If you develop symptoms, stay home. But otherwise, for people who are boosted or recently fully vaccinated, no quarantine period suggested, you know, masking for 10 days. And of course, there is the quarantine suggested if you're not boosted, if you're unvaccinated. And that is the stay home for 5 days and wear a mask an additional time. So I do think that it is a big change and something to really try to pay attention to, you know, these delineations. But I think it also shows the importance and the confidence we have in the booster helping, so that with getting a booster, you actually are able to, you know, cut that quarantine time, at least based on these suggestions now, and wear a mask for 10 days and then, you know, get tested on day five. And if you become positive, then, of course, make decisions based now on having that positive test.
What do you make of how these changes were communicated to the public? I mean, we're in such a high surge right now. It seems like a little bit of whiplash.
There is some confusion about this change happening now when people do have concerns about, you know, this variant and the surge and what the next few weeks are going to bring. So I think that we do need more communication about where this is coming from, what the science currently is. But the idea being, as I mentioned, this balancing act between people doing the things they need to do kind of in day-to-day life, you know, with what we know about the virus so far. I think that certainly we know that, you know, the vaccine and the booster is giving protection. So people should feel confident, I think, in the changes made around that. And hopefully, even though these are, you know, the guidelines could be a bit confusing, I do think on first read, hopefully it will help to encourage more people to get vaccinated and boosted.
And can you talk about how these CDC guidelines compare to the guidelines from other countries? I've heard that just Canada up north, it's a way different situation.
Yeah, I think it's different place to place. And people really, you know, public health officials, I think, have to make the decisions based on their local situation. You know, what are the vaccines available? What is the vaccination status of their population? And, you know, what they're seeing currently as far as hospitalization, you know, positive rates, things like that. So I think that it is a very individual situation from kind of location to location. And there are differences, definitely. You know, these are decisions based looking at the data in the US, and they certainly may change over time as we learn more, but it's different on the ground in every place, in large part due to differences in levels of vaccination.
And on being vaccinated, what's the impact of how long ago a person was fully vaccinated when it comes to these isolation times?
So if you were vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer or Moderna, over 6 months ago, so you become eligible for the booster, you know, once you've been vaccinated over 6 months ago. So if you have not been boosted, even though you received those vaccines over 6 months ago, or J&J over 2 months ago and are not boosted, then you in these guidelines are, following the same suggestions of people who are unvaccinated. So it's stay at home for if exposed, then to quarantine or stay at home for 5 days. And after that, mask around others for 5 additional days and test on day 5, if possible, and ideally test on day 5.
Okay. Well, since this is so confusing, can you repeat the guidelines in case anyone listening missed them the first time?
Yes. So I think a take-home message is that isolate, if you test positive for COVID-19, that everyone, regardless of vaccination status, being suggested to isolate, stay home for 5 days. If you are asymptomatic or your symptoms are truly resolving, so you don't have any fever, haven't had a fever, for instance, for at least 24 hours, so no symptoms, symptoms really resolving, then you can leave your house after 5 days, but it's important to continue wearing a mask for an additional 5 days. The differences come based on vaccination status when we're talking about quarantine, which is when you've been exposed to someone with COVID-19. So if you have been boosted or if you've completed the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine recently, so within 6 months, or the J&J vaccine, you've received it recently within 2 months, then you actually can wear a mask around others for 10 days, so without quarantine. So you need, it's important to wear that mask around others and to test on day 5, ideally, but you actually do not have to quarantine if you've been boosted or recently vaccinated. If you have not been boosted, but you're eligible for a booster, so you've completed the Pfizer or Moderna in over 6 months ago and have not been boosted, or the J&J over 2 months ago and have not been boosted, or you're not vaccinated, then you do need to quarantine following exposure to someone with COVID-19, which means staying home for 5 days, and after that, wearing a mask for an additional 5 days, and testing again, ideally on day 5, if possible.
Whew, well done. Nemanja Bumpus is the director of the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Nemanja, thank you for coming on and doing that heavy lift.
Thank you for having me.
If you're one of the more than 35 million student loan borrowers in this country who haven't made a payment since March 2020, this one's for you. Last week, President Joe Biden once again extended the moratorium suspending student loan repayments, this time through the end of April. Another 4 months potentially saving an extra $400 or $500 a month sounds like a good deal, right? But those against any student debt collection say this only postpones the financial hardship of repayments, a hardship shown to disproportionately impact Black student loan borrowers. Compared to their white peers, they often owe 50% more in debt, are almost 25% more likely to have a balance higher than their original loan, and are less likely to deduct complete interest payments on their taxes. On average, white college grads have 7 times more wealth. The pause on repayments was always intended to end eventually. It was originally set to expire back in September, then in August, it was extended through January of the new year. Now debt collection is pushed back again, with repayments planned to start May 1st.
A smooth transition back into repayment is a high priority for the administration.
But progressive politicians, advocates, and academics believe if the burden of loans can be continuously delayed, surely they can be canceled altogether. They say canceling student loan debt could increase the U.S. GDP by more than $173 billion. For more on this, I spoke with Andre Perry, senior fellow at Brookings Metro, who says this boost to the economy would be a key step in fulfilling Biden's promise to increase Black wealth in this country and narrow the racial wealth gap.
The timing is a little curious, to say the least. I don't think it's a coincidence that the administration announced that they were going to extend after Manchin made his announcement. And the reason given is that they needed to get a handle on the pandemic, which is certainly true. The economy is still tenuous at best, and so that makes sense. But clearly, everyone sees that the Biden administration needed to respond to progressives who are growing more and more impatient with not seeing their agenda come to fruition. So it's disheartening, to say the least, because Biden ran on the promise that he would cancel at least $10,000 of student debt.
So what's going on?
So for me, I say this, racism doesn't always show up with tiki torches and racial epithets. Most often it occurs with disregard. And in politics, there's been colorblind sort of approaches to policymaking that has placed Black issues in the margins. Student debt is an economic issue, but it is also a Black issue that we demanded a change. Common mistakes in the student loan cancellation debate is this assumption that all students across similar income strata have the same ability to pay. It's the use of income as a criteria to establishing policy. When you use income as the only measure, you essentially bury your head in the sand to the discrimination that has throttled Black wealth over the centuries. And so when Biden and others essentially say that the economy is doing fairly well and students can begin to pay back their student loans, it's ignoring the fact that Black people are much more likely to be or have low wealth. In fact, most student borrowers have low to negative wealth, and Black people are twice as likely than white people to be in that position. And so when you don't attend to wealth, you are essentially thumbing your nose at the realities that Black people face every single day.
Right. I saw a study from the Roosevelt Institute a few days ago estimating that Black wealth would increase by about 40% if the burden of student loans was lifted. And when I heard about the repayment deadline getting pushed back, I guess the first thing I thought was, it doesn't seem like the system is exactly relying on all this money from indebted folks in order to function, right? Like, people aren't making payments and somehow the earth is still spinning on its axis. Is there any reason why that shouldn't be the lesson from the extension?
Actually, during the pandemic, one of the bright spots was that when we froze student loans, you started to see Black millennials in particular to purchase homes, to improve their financial standing. The economy itself stabilized. And so what we're realizing now is what would the world look like if we did cancel student debt? And it would be a much better place, particularly for low wealth individuals, particularly for Black and brown people.
So what exactly would President Biden have to do in order to cancel student debt?
Well, it's legal scholars tend to agree that the Secretary of Education essentially can cancel the student debt. And as I mentioned, he's already done it for different groups on a number of occasions. So all he would do is essentially have to direct his Secretary of Education to do so. He can't necessarily blame Manchin on this. He can't blame a recalcitrant Republican Party on this. This is about his ability to cancel student debt. We're not necessarily moving towards equity that he proposed in some of his early executive orders, that he wanted to close the wealth divide. Well, the one thing that is in your control, you can do, and you're not doing it.
Well, what about pressure in the other direction? Are there private actors who have influence here who are benefiting from the student loan system?
Oh, certainly. There's a banking community that benefits. The higher ed community is not demanding to cancel student debt. And I was a former dean, a former professor. I've seen presidents raise tuition for budgeting mistakes, for their own agendas. And so we don't have this push from the larger political ecosystem, but it is coming from students and working class families themselves. The canceling student debt will ultimately move us towards a system of free college, at least in the public realm.
Do you know what the polling tells us about how popular student loan cancellation might be?
According to a poll sponsored by the civil rights organization Color Change, 40% of Black voters are unwilling to vote for a candidate who opposes eliminating student debt. politically, Biden should have signed an executive order to cancel student debt on his first day in office. It is a very popular idea to cancel student debt. And what you hear from a lot of critics is that there are other ways to help low wealth individuals. But I say this all the time. At what point does an administration listen to Black voters?
Could Biden or his team work at the edges of student loan cancellation, maybe canceling interest payments or something like that?
We have debt cancellation for folks who work in public service, for instance. But at the end of the day, it's the $1.7 trillion in debt owed that puts not only the economic fortunes of individual families at risk, but the entire economy at risk. Tuition keeps rising, and the wealth profile of those who are going to college aren't improving along with that rise. We cannot ask Black and Brown people in particular to carry the burden of us waiting for a new system to take hold. And so, yeah, we can work around the edges, but at some point, we have to deliver on the promise of canceling student debt.
You mentioned critics saying that there are other ways to increase Black wealth in this country. What are those other ways that they're proposing? And do they feel disingenuous to you?
There's still this belief that student loan cancellation is regressive, meaning it primarily helps the wealthy. And we know most student debt is held by people with zero to negative net worth. But you hear this persistent drumbeat that it's going to help doctors, for instance. And, you know, and during a pandemic, I say, well, there's actually nothing wrong with forgiving student loan debt for people contributing to society. But there's an overall sort of belief system that we should not invest in working class people. And also you will hear from critics, well, I paid my student loan 30 years ago. Well, in 30 years, tuition has increased threefold. It is not the same economic reality. When you only look at income and not at wealth, you are basically saying, hey, we're going to ignore the discrimination in the labor market. We're going to ignore decades and decades of housing discrimination that prohibited people from creating wealth. We're going to ignore the housing devaluation, which sees Black homes in Black neighborhoods underpriced by 23%, on average about $48,000 per home. Cumulatively, there's about $156 billion in lost equity in Black neighborhoods. We're just going to ignore all that, and you're just going to pay up.
Have you ever heard of an argument against canceling student loan debt that you found actually compelling?
No. There was a time when higher ed was a luxury. You could be middle class and not necessarily go to college. Those days are long over. That college has become as basic as a K-12 education. But we're asking people to go into debt to benefit society overall. We need people to be highly educated, particularly in an era of automation. It's actually enabling us to be fully human. We need people to go to college to get higher order thinking skills. And this is a good thing. And we can do that if we do not burden people with loans. And so for me, it's not a compelling argument to say we should not cancel student debt because of these reasons. No, we need for people to have access to college as much as possible.
I've been speaking with Andre Perry, senior fellow at Brookings Metro. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, what's it been like for people who haven't had to make student debt payments since March 2020? Sounds like the pause has been a huge relief.
The federal student loan repayment moratorium has been a benefit to me. I've been able to pay down credit cards and even start saving a little bit of money for the first time in my life.
Terry from Queens, New York. I have $100,000 in student debt from graduate school, which I finished in 2019. For the last, 6 weeks or so, I've been getting emails about having to call in to set up my repayment plan. And I was sweating because I'm also out of work. So when I heard that the moratorium had been extended for a few more months, I was very glad because I'm hoping that I will find a job before the moratorium ends and I can get back on some kind of schedule repaying this money, although it'll probably take me for the rest of my life.
Hi, this is Travis from Columbus, Ohio. I graduated with my master's in psychology in 2015, and the best paying job I could find out of school paid $18.50 an hour working for the state of Ohio. The 2020 loan repayment moratorium allowed me, for the first time in my life, to set aside a small amount of money for investing, safety net savings, etc. My investments in crypto and traditional stocks have paid off greatly, and for the first time, I'm starting to feel like I'll be able to crawl out of the debt instead of facing negative amortization of my loans, which happened for the first few years after graduating.
My name is Andrea Thomas. I'm calling from Midlothian, Texas. Yes, the student loan pause has definitely impacted me in a positive way. I was paying about $1,400 a month in student loans, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. But my husband and I were able to purchase our forever home. I've been able to pay down some debt because I've not been having to pay the albatross around my neck, which is student loans.
This is Stephen Phillips from Two Harbors, Minnesota. Gratefully, the moratorium has been a fantastic opportunity for my daughter, who has both undergrad and law school student debt. It's also been invaluable for myself, the Parent Plus loan. I'm on a Social Security disability income and just recently lost my employment driving for the local transit authority due to an occupational injury that I was not allowed to return to work from. So when this eventually returns, it may cost me my home.
My name is Melissa. I'm in Pittsburgh. And yes, the federal student loan moratorium has definitely impacted me financially. Not having the burden of the student loan debt on a monthly basis has given me the freedom to actually pay down other debts that I had and plan a little bit more for retirement and just plan for my future more, which is something that I could not do with a student loan payment of over $2,000 a month.
Hi, my name is Nick from Tuckahoe, New York. The federal student loan repayment moratorium has allowed my wife and I, who both have federal student loans, to finally save up some money for a down payment for a house. While we haven't purchased a house yet because of the insane housing market, we're starting to get nervous that as the repayments come back in early next year or later, that we may be dipping into the savings that we've already put down.
Hi, this is Liz from Orlando, Florida. The moratorium on student loan payments has absolutely affected me and my immediate family financially. For the first time in years, I was actually able to put away money into a savings account. I'm 32 years old and I am now halfway toward a down payment on a house, and that wouldn't have been possible without this pause on student loan payments.
Thanks to all of you who called to share your experiences. You can always give The Takeaway a call at 877-869-8253 or record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met and telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Last weekend, musical artist J Balvin accepted the African Entertainment Award for Afro-Latino Artist of the Year. And that announcement quickly sparked a backlash because he's a white Colombian. Something the artist acknowledged in a subsequent Instagram post where he wrote, "I am not Afro-Latino, but thank you for giving me a place in the contribution of the Afrobeat music and movement." It comes after prior bad behavior from Balvin. There's his video for the song Perra, which came out earlier this year. In it, he has two black women on leashes, walking like dogs in front of him. He also apologized for that decision, writing, "I want to say sorry to whomever felt offended, especially to the Black community. That's not who I am. I'm about tolerance, love, and inclusivity." Whomever felt offended? Because this is radio, you can't see how far back my eyes are currently rolling. But Balvin is emblematic of a bigger problem. There's been a whitewashing of reggaeton since the beginning. Reggaeton, first known as reggae en español, goes all the way back to the 1980s in the country of Panama. The purveyors were Black kids, descendants of those who had come from the West Indies to work on the Panama Canal. They took reggae and translated it into Spanish. One of the originators who would help to revolutionize the music into reggaeton music we know today was this man, El General, whose song Muévelo you're hearing right now. Muévelo, 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 mami, ahora tienes que parar. Yet the history of reggaeton that most people hear begins in Puerto Rico and centers around music of artists like Daddy Yankee and rarely goes back to the likes of El General and La Atrevida. And even when the story is told about Puerto Rico, the focus is on stars like Daddy Yankee and erases giants like Tego Calderon, an Afro-Puerto Rican pillar of the genre. The erasure of Black people and Black women from reggaeton is intentional. That's why J Balvin has been dragged for accepting the Afro-Latino Award and why his apologies seem to fall flat. With me now is Zaida Kelly Cabrera, artist, writer, speaker, and sociocritic, who joins us from the Dominican Republic. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I think there's some context that people need to understand here, especially racially in Latin America for Black people. Can you help our audience understand those dynamics a bit more?
I mean, really, the context is that the racial hierarchy in Latin America is not very different from the U.S. Despite all the woo-woo-woo, we are a rainbow, we're all mixed, there's a racial democracy, we don't think about that. I mean, really, actually, I would say it's worse. Because if you turn on the TV in Latin America, you will only see white Latinos. They would like to pretend that indigenous people and Black people in Latin America do not exist. You will not find us in government, except for very, very rare occasions. We're just generally kept out of social life. Latinidad is just viewed as only white Latinos and light-skinned mestizos. So, you know, we lack the most resources, Black and Indigenous people, the least access to education, to money, to resources like water, electricity, to state resources. Like, our communities don't get roads and that kind of thing. So there is no racial democracy. And then in Latin American music, the industry pretty much excludes Black people. They'll have a couple token Black men, but Black women at the level of someone like J Balvin or Karol G or the Daddy Yankees or whoever, like, it's just absolutely unseen. You turn on the radio, you will never hear a Black girl. It's just how it is.
There was this very telling interview, I think, in which J Balvin said he didn't see a future for him in reggaeton earlier in his career until he realized that Daddy Yankee looked like him and not like Tego Calderon, who, as I mentioned, is Afro-Puerto Rican. He said, "Vi que se abrió un camino. Vi que Yankee era blanco, un latino como yo." So I saw Daddy Yankee was white, a latino like me. And the implication there, as I heard it, was that Tego Calderon, who is black, is not latino. Is that how you unpack that statement too?
Absolutely. And it just goes to show, like, Latinidad is structured so that we see it as non-black, essentially. And that is why most people, Latinos and non-Latinos included, have a hard time processing the fact that there are black Latin Americans. So what we have is a lot of people cosplaying black. We can find white Latinas doing their hair like black girls, dancing, dressing, doing black girl music, but you will not find a black girl because we are not supposed to be in those spheres. We're not Latina, right?
I noticed that this award is from a group called the African Entertainment Awards USA, and then they responded to this controversy by renaming the category the Best Latin Award. Do you know what happened there? Like, what was going on?
I mean, on their part, it's just like a huge failure to even acknowledge the enormous amount of Black, like, descended people who live in Latin America right now, because they're calling him the bridge between Africa and Latin America. And it's like, we're the ones who created that genre, the Black people in Latin America. We are the bridge. We are the descendants. So it's just like, because of the way Latinidad is structured and just general anti-Blackness, even people from Africa do not comprehend that there are Black people in Latin America who actually have way more of a claim, because it is ours, you know, the Afro-descended music as well. To name a white man the bridge between Africa and Latin America when there are so many Black people who he is actually cosplaying, that's like just absolutely ridiculous. Like, so out of touch, and like the allyship, like even intra-communally, just like completely lacked right there as well.
Have there been any positive changes that you've seen in the Latin music world when it comes to racial equity in recent years?
Honestly, I'm not trying to sound pessimistic, but if in 2021, I still do not see a single Black woman anywhere to be found while everyone is cosplaying us, I cannot tell you that there has been some huge progress. The only Black girl that you ever see, and she's tokenized, is from Choquip Town, from Colombia. She's Goyo. She's amazing. But the fact that that is the only person, and she's like relegated sort of to background all of the time anyway, is just like, it just doesn't bode well. It doesn't make me feel hopeful, like that things are actually changing. Everyone is just focused on trying to be us, but without us.
Does the colorism that you're describing also translate to album sales and chart numbers? Are white Latinos also profiting off of reggaeton more than Afro Latinos?
Well, that is the thing. Appropriation is a conversation that is not only happening in the U.S. A lot of people will pretend that we do not discuss this in Latin America, but if you speak to any Black activists in Latin America, you will find that we do talk about it. So it's just like, yes, it is appropriation when it is only white Latinos who you see on the charts making bazillions of dollars, and someone like J Balvin is absolutely completely like filthy rich off of basically Black everything, while Black people cannot get anywhere near that. We're told that we are not marketable. That is why Dominican people, like, also everyone takes our slang. Everyone is coming to DR to record everything. We produce so many things for everyone, but we are not the ones making the money. White Latinos are. That is not sharing. It's appropriation. When you are the ones who are the center and the face of everything, and the people who created it are basically marginalized to the background.
You mentioned Choquip Town. Are there other artists that people should be listening to who are Afro Latino, who are not J Balvin?
I absolutely love Sech. I love Los Racas. I love Ozuna as well. And you already mentioned Tego Calderon. But yeah, Isa. She was actually also nominated for that award and did not win. She is a gorgeous, super talented girl from Brazil. Ludmilla.
You know, I've seen my Twitter feed and my Instagram feed blow up with this J Balvin news. And since you're in the Dominican Republic, I wonder if the conversation is also taking place there. Was this big news?
People kind of like roll their eyes and side-eyed. But for the most part, it's like that kind of news did not necessarily get here in the same way. And the politics here, a lot of people in the music industry are more focused on sort of like kissing of white Latinos, because they think that that is the only route. So it's like people are actually afraid to say something against this man. There has still been a lot of like people like ridiculing the entire decision all over social media. But from the industry, it's been quiet, because it's like, you don't want to burn those bridges. because the only way to get on is through these same white Latinos that appropriate you, you know?
So how do you find a way out of this dynamic? Is it just more conversations, or is there action that needs to be taken? Like, what happens next?
What happens next is, like, honestly, I don't see a way to actually force racist white Latinos to somehow let people into their industry. In the Dominican Republic, the biggest industry for music right now is dembow, and it is very much run by Black Dominican artists. We have our own scene, our own industry, and all of that. And, like, to me, that is really the only way. Because begging them for inclusion, that's not going to work. And clearly they have no intention of changing. Everyone keeps telling me that the documentary J Balvin did for Complex is full of him playing victim, because he's completely aware of all the things people are saying about his appropriation and his anti-Blackness. And, like, to him, he's a victim. He's not doing absolutely anything wrong. So literally, there is no telling these people anything either, you know? Us doing our own things is basically all it is. And it's an uphill battle because we have the least resources in Latin America to do these things to begin with. And yet we are still here being the cultural producers that they are copying, you know?
You mentioned that there in some ways that the racial dynamics in Latin America are even worse than in the United States. Is there a difference in the music scene in the U.S. than what you're describing in Latin America?
Listen, in the United States, you can turn on the radio and find a bunch of Black girls. We have our Beyoncés. We have our Whitney Houstons. We have a million Black girls that you can look to. In Latin America, you turn on the radio, you will not find a single Black woman. We're just not there. Same with television. You just will not find us. You know, it's just like a completely different context where it's like in the U.S., Black people are hyper visible. That's part of the anti-Blackness. But in Latin America, we're invisibilized. So it's like we just do not have a place in our own music, which is really the kicker.
Do you want to give us a particular song to go out on today?
I really love Stretch, Me Olvide.
Tell us about the song.
I feel like it's so forward thinking. It really expands on reggaeton. Also, he's like an OG because he's actually from Panama. Black Panamanian who are who started this, but it's like very jazzy elements that you do not usually hear in reggaeton. Like, it really moves away from just like the basic beats and is like, it's just a beautiful song musically and lyrically, and I think that people are not used to hearing that in reggaeton as well.
Zaira Kelly Cabrera is artist, writer, and sociocritic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we have for you today. And let me say, it's been such a pleasure being here with you all week. MHP is back tomorrow. If you want to hear more about the history of reggaeton, there's a fantastic podcast called Loud, just something you might enjoy over the holiday weekend. It's hosted by the legendary Evie Queen, and I'll go back to my day job at WNYC Studios, where, among other things, I'm the host of La Brega. That's a podcast in English and Spanish all about Puerto Rico. We have a new episode dropping January 6th. Happy Reyes, everyone! And make sure you follow the Takeaway podcast, of course. And hey, send them a tweet at The Takeaway, and you can find me at Alana Yama. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Alana Casanova Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway.